Hello, and welcome to the seventh episode of Season 8 of The Dark Money Files, in which we shine a light into a murky world. I'm Ray Blake, and with me is my co-host, friend, and business partner, Graham Barrow. Hello, Graham.
Hello, Ray.
We promised a colourful episode this time, didn't we, Graham?
Yes, we did. So often the colour we fixate on is red, and I think that while there are very good reasons for doing so, it does mean we can become a bit blinkered.
So by red, you're talking, I guess, about the things that are bad, high-risk things.
Well, yes, but in that one sentence, you've kind of encapsulated the problem.
Oh, have I?
Yes. You defined red first, Ray, as denoting things that are bad, by which I guess you mean things that might be criminal or at least unethical, right?
Yep, that's what I meant.
But then you went on to define it a second time as things that are high risk.
Yeah, I see what you mean. That's not the same thing at all, really, is it?
Well, no, it isn't. When we talk about high-risk situations, we're only talking about possible indications of wrongdoing or about there being certain conditions in which wrongdoing might be prone to emerge. Your family medical history, for example, might mean you have a high risk of heart disease, but that doesn't mean that you have it, nor that you will ever have it.
No, that's right. But it's worth keeping a close eye on, I suppose, and taking steps to see whether I do actually have it or whether a test can establish that I'm currently disease-free.
There you go. Point made, I hope.
Yeah, very much so. But thinking about the health analogy, there's another angle here. Some conditions you can treat straight away or manage on an ongoing basis. If you've got type 2 diabetes, for example, you don't just have to sit there monitoring it and waiting to see if it begins to adversely affect your life expectancy.
No, indeed. You can make changes now that will limit or possibly even remove the risk of developing lasting illness from type 2 diabetes.
And we often face that situation with a client, don't we?
What, with type 2 diabetes?
No, with the ability to make changes now or manage an ongoing situation.
Yes, we do. We can find a client whose overall risk to us is high only because of one particular aspect, and it may well be that we can put a specific limit or control in place that addresses that concern fully, at which point the client effectively ceases to be high risk. We've cured, or at least we've been able to treat, the underlying condition.
Great. So, back to the meaning of red flags. When we talk about a red flag, that may or may not be indicative of crime, but it should prompt us to make further inquiries and analyse the situation.
Indeed, Ray, and the outcome of that might be that we confirm a suspicion of criminality, or that we can gain comfort that there is legitimacy, or we may not be able to tell either way and need to keep a close eye on the situation.
So I think we're all comfortable with that approach, Graham. That's the job, isn't it?
Well, yes, it is. But I often think it might be somewhat of an inefficient approach.
Tell me more about why, Graham.
Well, if you think about it, your entire approach is to look for and find criminal activity, yeah?
Yep.
But actually, wouldn't it also help to be able to identify what's strongly likely to be non-criminal, legitimate activity?
But we do, don't we? That's what's left after we investigate red flags and are satisfied, isn't it?
Well, that's one way to get there, certainly, to presume guilt, if you like, then see if we can establish innocence.
Actually, when you put it like that...
Sounds a bit off, doesn't it?
And when you think about it, it's an entirely reactive approach. The only reason we get comfortable is because we start off uncomfortable.
And that, Ray, is a fantastic point.
Is it?
Yes. You just said the only reason we get comfortable is because we start off uncomfortable. We only look for problems.
Yeah, I see what you're getting at. If we only look for problems, all we'll find is problems.
Yeah, that's exactly it. It's a bit like with people. You can either say, I will not trust you until you prove your trust, or I will trust you until you prove you are not trustworthy. I think they're different. So I think we're missing a very important trick where we don't look for green flags as well as for the red ones.
Now, what do you mean by a green flag, Graham?
Well, it's the opposite of a red flag, Ray. It's an indicator that there may be a known legitimate activity that we can establish through checking.
And what good will that do us, Graham?
Well, Ray, if you think about the whole of our transactional activity in a given day for all of our clients as a swimming pool, our red flags help us mark off the deep end. That's where the danger is most likely to be. If it's the only danger we perceive, that is a problem. But also, we never really carve out much of the shallow end.
We don't need to spend our time there, Graham. We're busy at the deep end, looking closely at what's going on there.
True, but then we have the main part of the pool, which certainly isn't risk-free and that we can't ignore. If we could work out how far the shallow end extends, we might be able to make the job of oversight more manageable.
Okay, so currently, if we're just looking for red flags, we have a deep end and then everything else. You're saying we could also establish a shallow end by actively looking for signs of legitimacy as well as signs of criminality.
Exactly that, Ray.
Give me an example of some green flags, Graham.
Well, let's take retail banking, Ray. If we see a monthly sum going out of a current account to a lender that's about the same every month, that's really likely to be you repaying a loan. That could be a green flag.
And similarly, signs of a regular salary coming in?
Exactly. And for a business account, there might be regular supplier payments or rent or payroll, that sort of thing.
And receipts from what look like sales to genuine clients?
Quite so, Ray. It might not be quite as easy as just accepting these as legitimate, much as we wouldn't just conclude a red flag represents criminality.
No, but you can look at a red flag in context or look at a cluster of red flags and quickly decide whether you have a problem or not. So I guess it could be the same for a green flag, right?
Yes, I think so. It requires the same approach. Look at the context, check the nature and purpose, compare it with similar activities we've seen, possibly check with the customer or look at publicly available information to get some of that context.
Now, it sounds like you're piling on a bit of a workload here, Graham. If as well as red flags, we have to start looking at green ones as well, won't that make everything harder?
Well, I suppose it might in the short term, but longer term, if you're looking at transaction monitoring that takes account of green flags as well as red ones, you might find that the alerts that need to be escalated actually fall overall and over time. The green flag activity had already provided necessary context before the red flag alert comes to you, putting you in a much better position to make a quick decision.
So effectively, you'd be maintaining a list of rules and scenarios in your transaction monitoring that looked for expected and legitimate behaviour as well as the anomalous and suspicious behaviour.
Yes, Ray. What you might think of as innocent typologies as opposed to criminal typologies.
Okay, right. So how's this different from whitelisting, Graham?
I think there's a world of difference, Ray, but it's a really, really important question. So first of all, do you want to explain the concept of whitelisting?
I will, Graham. And first of all, let me express a certain amount of discomfort with the language. This is the term used pretty much universally in our business and others, but we do need to come up with a less loaded term, really.
Yeah, something like, I don't know, clear listing, maybe? I don't know, but I do agree.
Fair enough. Anyway, it describes the process whereby once a particular alert is deemed to be benign and not in fact represent a risk, the subject of that alert can be removed from future scrutiny.
Yes, and that removal might be for a fixed period or it might be forever.
Now, I can see potential problems with the approach, Graham.
Such as?
Well, what's acceptable in one context might not be acceptable in another one. And if you stop looking, you'd never get a prompt to reconsider.
No, that's quite true. And often whitelists have a ticking clock attached to them that forces their members to be reviewed regularly for continued inclusion.
I can also see criminals exploiting whitelists by making benign transactions they believe will put them on the whitelist. then making less benign ones subsequently. And they wouldn't have to get away with that for very long to move an awful lot of dark money, potentially.
You are right, of course. Then there's human nature to think about too. If the fire alarm keeps going off and there's never a fire, you'll be less inclined to believe there's a fire next time it sounds.
Oh yes, I've experienced that.
And where you can be reasonably convinced that an alarm in certain conditions never means there's a fire, it's reasonable to adjust the alarm to silence it in such instances in the future.
I can feel a but coming on, Graham.
You're not wrong, Ray, and here it comes now. But imagine if you go further and prevent the alarm from sounding whenever the known benign cause is in play, but there is a situation where there is also a real threat.
So where you've stopped the alarm going off for one thing, but that means it won't go off for another thing happening at the same time.
Exactly that. So you've noticed the fire alarm goes off whenever there are high winds, and you've established that this is the causative factor. So whenever there's a high wind, you prevent the alarm from sounding. And that means no one has to pile out of the building just because an oversensitive sensor has tripped.
Okay.
But let's say that one time it's windy, there is also an actual fire. The system recognises the wind, knows that that's benign, and therefore doesn't sound the alarm. Meanwhile, the place begins to burn down in silence.
I get it. You need to be sure in whitelisting something, a type of transaction, a specific person or entity or a pattern of activity, that won't have the unintended consequence of allowing something that's not so benign to go under the radar.
That is exactly right, Ray.
So how is developing green flags different from whitelisting, Graham?
Because flags are not lists, Ray.
Well, that's very gnomic. You might have to expand on that a little, Graham.
Okay. How did we define a red flag earlier?
As an indicator that there might be a suspicious activity.
And therefore a green flag by extension?
Well, I suppose that's an indicator that there might be a legitimate activity underway.
Exactly. Both of those just point up likelihoods or indications. Each needs to be reviewed every time.
Yeah, that's true.
But a whitelist goes much further. It stops you even seeing a flag in certain situations. So it's not just that you're able to easily clear an alert. You don't get the alert.
Yeah, I can see that's potentially quite a dangerous step, isn't it? And yet there are, I'd suggest, situations where whitelisting is still the right thing to do.
Such as?
Well, let's say a screening system alerts on a new client that I'm onboarding whose name is the same as a PEP or a sanctioned person. Now, I've determined that although their name is the same, it's definitely not them because they're not the same age or they can show a different residence or nationality.
Yes. You wouldn't want that to keep alerting on the same hit once you've discounted it, but you'd need to be careful to make sure that any different hits on that client's name, or indeed hits on any other clients on the sanctioned or politically exposed person, were not suppressed by that listing.
That's a very good point, and one I'd never thought of until now.
So green flags that you look at each time rather than white listing, that means you lose the opportunity to look, is, I think, a better general approach.
And I like the idea that in looking proactively for the good stuff as well as the bad stuff, we'll get a less jaundiced view of our customers and their actions.
That is an appropriately colourful term there as well, Ray.
It's been quite a colourful discussion, Graham.
Well, it has. So what's next then?
Well, looking beyond the festive season and some well-earned excess.
I am looking forward to it.
well, quite so. Looking beyond that, 2022 is going to be an interesting year. I think we should see what the landscape looks like once the festivities are behind us.
Yes, but honestly, Ray, I'm pretty sure our listeners will be keen for our take on the recent NatWest and, very recently, HSBC's AML fines.
So let's start there in 2022. Once the dust of opprobrium settles, I think we should dig deep and give a rather more balanced analysis of what's gone on there than much of the commentary so far has provided.
I think that would be a good start to the new year, Ray.
I'm looking forward to it.